Trojan fans, it's time for another installment of the Trojan Blast Recruiting Podcast. We give you the inside scoop on everything about USC football recruiting from the experts who know what they're talking about. Which players have an offer, which ones don't, who the coaches like, and who our experts like. And now, here are your co-hosts for the Trojan Blast Recruiting Podcast, USCFootball.com publisher Ryan Abraham and USCFootball.com national recruiting analyst Gerard Martinez.
Hello, Trojan fans. Obviously, this is not Ryan Abraham. This is Keely Yore subbing in for the very sick Ryan Abraham. I think he now has bronchitis, so he had to make a call to the bullpen, and I am now subbing in for the recruiting podcast with Gerard Martinez at GMART Live. This is the guy you want to talk to for anything and everything recruiting, and especially USC recruiting. So, Gerard, how are you doing? Did you survive the early signing period?
I survived the early signing period, and I survived Christmas, which were very, very close together. So
yes,
I gave more gift cards than I usually do because I didn't have the opportunity to go out and get specific shopping done. So, you know, you hit the CVS and they got a great array of gift cards. And so, you know, a few more people got gift cards than usual. Survived the early signing period, a crazy signing period.
Yes.
We'll probably talk a little bit about that, I'm sure, in some of the questions we get. It was nuts, but we survived. And now we go on to January, first with the Army All-American Bowl. And that will set off things. And then we get through the dead period and boom. It's going to be that 3-week period till signing day 2018.
Yeah, I mean, even though the early signing period is over, it's just beginning. This is just the start of all the madness, right?
It's really the start, but because such a large segment of the class is already signed, and not just for USC, but nationally. I mean, I think you're talking about a much higher percentage of guys that ended up signing, guys that are not even going to enroll early, than anybody anticipated. I don't think anybody thought that there were going to be as many top players that would be already signed, sealed, and delivered to their schools of choice at this point in the beginning of the year. I certainly didn't think it was. I still don't really understand completely the mentality and the reasons why so many kids signed early, especially if you're not going to be an early enrollee. I don't necessarily see the sense in it. And I think we'll probably see a little bit of a backlash from it. I think we'll see, you know, sort of maybe in a few years, we'll see kids kind of probably back off on it a little bit. I think it was a new thing and kids got sucked into it and schools were trying to make last minute steals with their visits and they pushed hard to try to get these kids signed. And I think some kids kind of fell into it and they got roped into it because it was the trendy thing to do and everybody was doing it. But I think over the next couple years, it'll probably get peddled back a little bit and we won't see quite as many guys sign early if the signing period actually even stays as it is right now.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we have a lot of questions to get into and this is a premium podcast. So thank you guys for your subscription. I hope you guys get a lot out of it. I think you will. But before we get into the questions, you kind of already got into it, but what were your impressions of this first signing day? Was it what you expected as far as, like you said, a lot of guys actually ended up signing?
Yeah, it was definitely a bigger group of guys than I thought that USC would aim for and USC would get. You have guys like Paliie Yoteote, five-star linebacker from Las Vegas Bishop Gorman High School, who is not going to be an early entrant. He can't be an early entrant out of Bishop Gorman. They actually don't allow that. Tate Martell last year actually had to transfer during his last semester to actually graduate from another high school so he could enroll at Ohio State early. So with Paliie, he's still at Bishop Gorman. He's not going to be able to be on campus for USC for spring ball, but he still decided he wanted to end the recruiting process and get it done completely. And so he signed with USC. So he's off the table. That's a guy that Ohio State was after. That's a guy that Alabama was after. Oregon was after. UCLA was after. Everybody was after him. And they wanted to try to bring him in on some official visits during the season. And he didn't. So now the only official visit he has is going to be USC in January. Like I said, he's not going to be an early enrollee, so he can take that visit in January. But he's off the table completely. And you have a few guys like that this year that, you know, just decided, even though they weren't going to enroll early, they still wanted to get the process done early. Raymond Scott's another guy, the 6'1", 220-pound, four-star linebacker from Harbor City, Narbonne High School. A guy that's going to be another Army All-American. You're going to have Paliie Yoteote and Raymond Scott both there at the Army All-American Bowl playing for the West Squad side by side. We saw them playing together a little bit at the opening finals up in Oregon. And so you've got those guys already done. They're done. They're not, we're not going to San Antonio to talk to Paliye Yoteote about his potential Ohio State visit or his potential Alabama visit. He's off the table. And I think that just totally changes the game a bit as we get into January. Now, is it going to make it that much harder for the guys that are still unsigned because there's less of them and there's going to be that much more scrutiny? The schools are going to hit them that much harder because there's less guys to actually cover. There are less calls to make. We're going to have to see how that goes because that's going to be interesting. You've got a guy like Julius Irvin, the 6'2", 190-pound cornerback slash safety from Servite High School in Anaheim. And he's a guy that was going to be an early signee. And USC, it looked like we're going to lose him to Notre Dame. And it was one of those things that was really strange because USC had sort of had the lead for a while. They recruited him really hard. Ronnie Bradford specifically is a position coach and being recruiting him really hard. And somehow towards the end of the process, USC sort of lost communication with him. There was a few weeks there where they weren't on top of him and they didn't know he was going to sign early. And so it was literally a few nights before the early signing period, he called USC and informed them, "I'm going to sign early." And there was a scramble and USC was basically saying, "Hey man, we really would like you to take your official visit. And we'd like you to have your in-home visit with Clay Helton before you make your decision." Somehow that got twisted and interpreted as, "Well, you're slow playing me." So Julius Irvin, all of a sudden, in his mind, went from being a guy that was a priority recruit for USC to someone that was actually being slow played. So all of a sudden, he started looking at Washington and Notre Dame, and it looked like Notre Dame was going to steal him in the 11th hour. But in the 11th hour of the 11th minute, USC was able, I think, to recruit him away from signing early. Now, he said he had a family emergency. He had some things come up, so he wasn't going to sign early. He was going to end up signing in February. But you know USC was lobbying in the background, "Hey, give us some more time. We haven't had Coach Helton come in and talk to you. We haven't had an official visit, and we know you've been here enough." And he's been on some unofficial visits and spent some time with the coaching staff. An official visit is a different deal. It really is different. And a lot of local recruits, they always say, "You know, I'm not going to take an official visit to USC or UCLA because I've been there unofficially." But then they take that official visit and they kind of see, yeah, it was actually a little different. I did get to spend more time with the players. I did get to spend more time with the coaches. I did get to see them away from football more, and it was important. So that's really what USC wanted with Irvin, and they're going to get it as he's going to actually officially visit in January. So you had those type of instances come up, and I did think there would be a few where you would get schools like Nebraska and Oregon and some other schools that would try to maybe steal some players at the last minute with some late visits and kind of, you know, just be able to kind of steal them away. And that was one of those situations where USC almost ended up on the bad end of that. So we'll see going forward as these schools start to become a little more, I guess, aware and get a feel for the early signing period and how they have to divvy up their visits and how they have to do things from a schedule and itinerary standpoint, because you have in-home visits going on for those 2 weeks. I think obviously the approach may be a little different, and you know, schools like USC will try to protect themselves more from those last minute sort of decisions where kids just all of a sudden decide to spring and go somewhere else at the last minute.
Yeah. As far as like, if you're a USC fan, how do you kind of evaluate what happened so far? I mean, you start off the day with Jackson Carman going to Clemson, and then you kind of end this period with JT Daniels reclassifying. Like, how do you process all that? And then you still have signing day coming up later on.
Yeah, I think it's a win for USC. It was a great day for USC. It was a great early signing period for USC. I think some fans took the Jackson Carman loss really hard, and it was a big loss. It was something that we talked about. USC doesn't have a lot of options at offensive tackle in this class, and so it is a bit of an issue for them. It's something that in January they're going to have to pivot a little bit. They're going to have to find some plan Bs. But I think with the signing of Jaden Woodby to Florida State, that's not such a big deal. Maybe it's a big deal superficially on the surface because it's a five-star safety and he's a local guy. But in terms of need and in terms of his talent and how he would fit in at USC, I think USC is going to be fine because really what we're doing with this signing period, we're opening with Jack Carman, who goes to Clemson, which was a shock to a lot of people, including USC. I don't think it really made sense to USC from an off-the-field standpoint. I think there was a lot of confidence that he would end up at USC if this was about more than football. But he goes to Clemson. And so you kind of wonder, well, was it more than football? I mean, if it was football, why didn't he just stay with Ohio State? A lot of questions. But look, Clemson's the national champion. You know, they're defending national champion. There's a program that's kind of on the rise, at least from a tradition standpoint, because they don't have a lot of tradition. They're certainly not in the same blue blood category as Ohio State, USC, or Alabama. But that's still a loss that it has a lot of people scratching their heads. So you open up with that. I understand it's kind of a little bit of a kick in the gut. But what we're really ending with is Talanoa Hufanga. And yeah, a lot of people forgot about him, but he's actually going to announce tomorrow his intentions of where he's going to sign. And as we've been saying all along here over the past pretty much week and a half, it looks like USC is in the driver's seat. We expect him to sign with USC. And that's a guy that, according to 24/7 Sports, is a five-star athlete. He's a guy that composite-wise is only a four-star, but the truth is 24/7 Sports have seen him much more than any other recruiting service, any other recruiting network, and so it stands to reason that they may rank him higher than other outlets. So, you know, according to the people that have seen him, he's better than Jaden would be. He's projected to be better than Jaden would be, 6'1", 195 pounds, a guy that plays defensive back, plays linebacker, plays running back up in Corvallis. The biggest questions about him are obviously the level of competition he's playing against, because when you're looking at Corvallis, Oregon, as opposed to maybe a guy like Jaden Woodby who's playing at St. John Bosco, you're playing against the toughest competition from a league standpoint, maybe in the whole country when you're at St. John Bosco. When you're in Corvallis, Oregon, not the same thing. So that would be the biggest question. But a lot of people have seen him play in person. They've seen him at the opening finals. They really like Talanoa Hufanga, and he's a guy that looks like he's going to go to USC. And so now you're capping the day with that. And then, oh, by the way, you also got Caleb Tremblay, who's a 6'5", 285-pound defensive tackle from American River Community College up there in Sacramento, a guy that really it looked like USC was going to lose during the early signing period. I mean, all my sources kind of gave me the vibe like he was 100% going to go to Washington. USC was trying to sort of slow play it a little bit. I think they were trying to figure out how many rides they would have and how many guys they could have early enrollees, because that's something that, you know, we talk about the early signing period. Some of these kids are just signing early, but some of them are enrolling early. And in order to have them enroll early, you have to have enough room on the 85 scholarship limit during the spring for them to come in. So you get those 85, and while there may be guys that are seniors that are graduating and they're not technically a part of 85, you know, fans always look at it and go, well, that guy's already graduating. He's not going to participate in spring ball, so you should have room. But that's not the way it works. The way it works for you or for the NCAA is that you have the whole cycle, both the fall and the spring semester, where if those guys are not graduate and they have not already gone through and they have their degrees and everything, then they remain on the actual on the scholarship roster total. So you have to know who's going to be actually graduating on time. You got any guys that are not graduating on time. You have to have room there to be able to get those early enrollees in so they can participate in spring ball. That happened to USC back in 2012 when Lane Kiffin was recruiting that class. And Kylie Fitz, who was a defensive end, a four-star at a Redlands East Valley High School, was a guy that was committed to USC, was set to enroll early at USC. But USC had a couple guys that were seniors that did not graduate on time, and they ended up still being on that 85 roster. So USC couldn't bring in Kylie Fitz. So they basically had to tell him, hey, man, you're going to have to come in June. He didn't like that. He ended up going to UCLA and then ended up transferring to Utah. But that's kind of one of those examples of you have to sort of know if you have enough room actually on that 85 limit to be able to bring these guys in. So with Caleb Tremblay, that was kind of a question, and it seemed like USC, I guess at some point they got an answer to that question. Maybe it was Jaden Woodby not going to USC, where they figured, okay, that's a guy we're not going to have on the roster during spring ball, so now we can green light Caleb Tremblay. But it seemed like with USC's hesitation, that was opening the door for Washington. And a lot of folks, you know, Brandon Huffman and myself both, if you would have, you know, asked us and put a gun to our heads and say, hey, you got to make a prediction there on the first day of the early signing period, where is Caleb Tremblay going to go? I think we both would have said Washington. And even the second day, we probably both would have said Washington. And he turns around and commits to USC. So that's a huge get, though, because, I mean, that's a plug-and-play type player. That's a guy that if maybe Rasheem Green leaves, that's a guy that you can plug in that has some maturity and has some ability from a physical standpoint to play right away, and you don't have to develop him and bring him in. And when you combine that with the class that USC brought in last year at defensive line, I mean, Kenichi Odizi's killing it on the recruiting trail. I mean, they still got some guys that they're going after. So it's really successful. It's been a very good early signing period for them. They lost, Jaden Woodby, and they lost Carmen. I think Carmen is really the more significant loss, and USC is going to have to pivot here in January to be able to make up that need at offensive tackle.
How much of this is a juggling act for the coaches? I mean, you just mentioned the whole early enrollee thing. That was a thing before the early signing period. Now, with this early signing period, you have to figure out scholarships before guys are actually leaving to the NFL. How much of that is a juggling act for these coaches?
It's all a juggling act, because there's still guys right now that are looking at the NFL that could potentially leave that you just don't know. You know, you just don't have any guarantees. I mean, we talked about the quarterback situation for a long time with Sam Darnold, and we gave plenty of hits about JT Daniels on the podcast, probably more hints on the podcast than we even did with the War Room. But it's one of those things where it really works for USC now, because if JT Daniels, regardless, he can redshirt and it's good, and you're obviously going to have four scholarship quarterbacks on the roster if Sam Darnold decides to return. But you got a guy there that is coming out a little early, and you say, well, you know what? True freshman, if you give him a red shirt, then you really look at him going, okay, he's a guy that could really replace Sam Darnold for sure. You give him the clear advantage, I think, in that competition moving forward. But if he has to come in and play right away, he's not going to actually enroll until June, from what we understand. And he's actually signing in February, even though he announced he's going to sign and reclassify here during the early signing period. That's going to be a little more difficult. I talked to Greg Biggins about it. He's seen a lot of JT Daniels. I've seen a lot of JT Daniels. Greg seems to think that he's going to be good enough. He can come in June, still be prepared enough for fall camp that he can win that job. I think it's going to be a little tougher. I think it would definitely have been an advantage if he could have got in during spring ball and been a part of spring ball just to get those reps, those 15 practices, to acclimate to the speed of the game and just sort of the level that he's playing at. Now, he played at modern day, and again, this kind of goes back with talking about Jaden Woodby versus Talanoa Hufanga, that level of competition. Modern day played everybody. I mean, they played the best against the best.
Yeah.
They have great players on their team, and they're playing against great teams with great players. So it's not going to be a real difficult transition for him from that standpoint, but it's still high school ball going to college ball, and it's difficult. And freshmen are going to make mistakes. And even though he may be the most cerebral quarterback that USC has brought in the past few years, it's still going to be a bit of a challenge for him to be as efficient as he can be and will be. And you know how USC fans are probably not going to be very patient with that. They saw Matt Barkley during his first year, and he was able to win some games, had a huge win at Ohio State, but then, had played like a freshman a lot too. And USC kind of were up and down that season. You kind of know what to anticipate with JT Daniels, not to necessarily make a direct comparison between he and Matt Barkley. They are two different players, but they are freshmen, and you can kind of know that you anticipate there's going to be some mistakes and some things that freshmen are going to do, and you have to have them grow. And when you only have, that summertime period, and then boom, you're right into fall camp, it's going to be a quick turnaround for him to be able to win that job outright day one as a starter.
Okay, well, that leads us to our questions. Let's go to Corey, who says, if JT Daniels reclassifies, which he did, can he blue shirt and count towards 2019? Are there any other blue shirt candidates?
That's a good question. I do not believe he can blue shirt, mainly because I think he's been recruited. And that's always sort of a vague gray area, because that term recruited, over the years, when it comes to blue shirts, what we've understood is it basically means an official visit or an in-home visit. So he can't have an in-home visit from a coach, and he can't officially visit USC. And to my knowledge, I don't believe JT Daniels has that either. I'm not 100% on the in-home visit, but I know he hasn't taken an official visit to USC yet. The other question, obviously, that would come up is the 85 limit and sort of where USC is with that. And I've heard that they're probably too close to bumping up on that 85 limit to actually push him forward into that 2019 class. So I don't think so. It's a good question. I don't know. Maybe there's some loopholes or something there, and I have to sort of ask around, but I would say 85% no. I don't think he can actually a blue shirt. As far as other blue shirts go, been a lot of talk about John Jackson Jr., and he potentially, actually the third, John Jackson the third, go ahead and blue shirt as a receiver from Sarah High School. 6'1", 190 pounds. The biggest issue with that is, again, I think it's going to be the 85, and really not even the 85, it's going to be the 25 rule. So the NCAA this past year, among other rules that they changed, they also updated that every single class has to be limited to 25. The SEC made a rule like this a few years ago where you couldn't oversign. And this year, it's basically you have to have your 25 per class. You can retroactively count last year's class with early enrollees towards this class because last year's class was not under this limit, not under this rule. Oregon is going to do that. Oregon is, I think, trying to bring in like 30 recruits for this class. But they're only doing it this one time because they're able to bring it and count it against last year's class, which was not under this specific rule. But everything going forward, and for USC, obviously, you can't do that, it's going to be 25 per class. And so that's going to limit a little bit of the gray shirting and the blue shirting that some of these schools have done because you're going to take away those rides from the next class, and it's not going to be a class that you already could maybe oversign a little bit and have some early enrollees. So it's going to restrict some things. And so a guy like John Jackson has been talked a lot about as a blue shirt. He was offered over the summer, and there was a lot of talk. Yeah, it was a legit offer, and he could come in anytime. But we knew all along it was not going to be because he would probably have committed right away on the spot. So going forward, he's a potential blue shirt option. We know USC wants to probably bring in at least two receivers. Three has been tossed around, and it was two for a while of the spring and during the summer. And then I heard from a great source, that it was going to be three, and they were going to try to get in three. But I think it's really one of those things where they have to sort of look at their positions, what they need, and it comes back to the best on the board. Are you going after a third receiver? Or are you going after maybe a tight end? Or are you going after a second running back? Or are you going after another offensive lineman? It always comes in. You know, that fifth linebacker spot is obviously floating around out there, and we now anticipate USC is going to take five linebackers in this class. So that's going to cut into other positions. Can you take three receivers with five linebackers in the class? Yeah, that seems like it's going to be difficult. So the blue shirts and the gray shirts and that stuff, that's going to be, I think, fewer and far between. It just depends on, I guess, at the last minute, if USC, you know, maybe they lose out on somebody that they think they're getting and they have that spot available. Perhaps it goes to a guy like John Jackson as a blue shirt.
We have another JT Daniels question, this time from Max in Venice. He says, JT Daniels reclassified into the 2018 class. Where does he rank nationally? I would assume he'd be a five-star, but how would he stack up against other top QBs, Lawrence and Fields? Would he still be a top 10 overall player?
Another good question, and a question that's actually been answered to some extent. He is ranked 21st nationally and sort of fits in there at the third position between Justin Fields and I think it's Tanner McKee is actually the fourth-ranked quarterback in the class. That's kind of a preliminary ranking. They have to still kind of look at him side by side. Obviously, you're looking at a guy, and he's been involved at events with other top quarterbacks, but it's a little different. You kind of look at him and say, okay, he's still got another year. And that mentally, when you're evaluating, it sort of changes your opinion and how you look at a specific prospect. So now when we're going to go to the Army All-American Bowl, because JT Daniels is playing in the Army All-American Bowl for the West team, we're going to look at him side by side really in the same arena as those other quarterbacks. And that opinion is going to change a bit, and his evaluation will change upon that. So right now he's third behind Trevor Lawrence and Justin Fields, but that could change. He could end up being ranked higher. He could slip a little bit. Just depending on what his performance is going to be at the Army All-American Bowl weekend.
Tarek asked, do you see USC getting involved again in Jalen Hall's recruitment?
I don't think so. I don't think he did enough during his senior year for USC to change their course of action. They've approached his recruitment with a lot of hesitation, I think, really kind of towards the middle of the summer. And thought, all right, you know, we're going to see what he does during his senior year. If he has a great senior year, then maybe we change some things. Maybe we come back on him and recruit him a little harder. But I just don't think he had that kind of year where that changes their approach at all. I think he's still down on the board below some other guys. I think a guy like Chris Oleve is a guy that has definitely jumped up on the board. 6 foot, 180-pound wide receiver from San Marcos down there in San Diego, Mission Hills High School. A guy that had a fantastic senior year, and you look at him on film and you see what he can do with the ball in his hands, He's also a very good defensive back as well. So kind of an overall athlete and a guy that can return kicks, a little different than maybe what USC has on their roster right now and on their depth chart at wide receiver. So that's a guy that I think is picking up a lot of momentum with USC. Obviously, they're still after Amon-Ra St. Brown, a guy who's a amazing potential receiver that can play in the slot. He can play outside. He can be a guy that's more of a possession guy, but he really runs really good routes, and he's quick enough and he's strong enough and aggressive enough that he can beat guys on the outside as well. And so certainly he's a priority recruit. So you kind of look at what they're lining up on. Devin Williams is another guy out of Lancaster, Antelope Valley High School, 6'5", 200 pounds, more of an athlete. He's a ranked a 5-star. Us personally at USCFootball.com, we've seen him, and he's been a little bit up and down, a little hot and cold, not really consistent, not a true dominant 5-star in my opinion, but a guy that obviously has a lot of potential from a raw athletic standpoint. And so that's another guy that USC is looking at and would be a counter to a guy like Amon-Ra St. Brown. Certainly a sort of, you know, you look at running backs and you look at the thunder and lightning type of thing. Well, sort of with receivers, you know, your big receiver versus your smaller receiver. Obviously, Oleve from a profile standpoint is similar to Amon-Ra St. Brown. But when you watch him, Oleve is closer to more of a Robert Woods, Marquise Lee type of guy in terms of how he plays. Whereas I would probably compare St. Brown more to a Deontay Burnett type of guy that really works the middle of the field really well. He works the hash marks really well. He just is a technician with his quickness and his hands and his ability just to sort of sense and have an awareness for zone coverage and get open. And so different kind of receivers, even though from a profile standpoint, they're sort of similar in terms of being 5'11", 6 foot, you know, 180, 185 pounds.
In that sense, Tark M. asks, is USC comfortable ahead of Notre Dame when it comes to landing St. Brown now that JT Daniels is coming for sure?
I think they have to be very comfortable. I think certainly JT Daniels was a big factor with Amon-Ra St. Brown. And now that he's coming in the same class and they're going to be on campus at the same time, I think it's huge because Amon-Ra St. Brown has talked a lot about JT Daniels and even talking about Notre Dame specifically, you know, was asked of him. You know, you're not going to have a guy like JT Daniels coming with you to Notre Dame as he's still committed to USC. How does that impact your decision when you're looking at other quarterbacks that Notre Dame may be recruiting and other quarterbacks they have on the roster? And he was very open saying, you know what, I like me some JT Daniels and I want to keep taking passes from a guy like JT Daniels, who I know from a timing standpoint and from an arm standpoint and just from a mental, you know, psychological standpoint, those guys almost have telepathy. They're on the same page. They have such great timing. It's really hard for a guy like Amon St. Brown to get away from playing with a guy like that. When you've had so much success, when you've been a part of the number one high school team in the country, one of the best high school teams ever, quite frankly, to ever play. I mean, we're talking about, you know, the great Moeller teams, the great De La Salle teams, Southridge, Miami. I mean, you can go through, you know, all these teams, Massillon, and, you know, modern day, that might be one of the best, if not the best, high school football team ever assembled. So you playing with that guy and you've had that much success, it's really tough to say no to the local school and a school that, even with those things off the board, would still be a school that you would seriously consider just with the tradition and your relationship with the coaching staff. So I have to think Amon-Ra St. Brown, who is right now, we're expecting, going to announce at the Army All-American Bowl, going to end up with USC.
Interesting. We have a question. It says, it seems we have recruited many offensive tackles in the past few years, so why is it so essential for us to recruit another tackle? And I know many tackles become guards. For USC, they eventually became guards.
Boom. You answered your own question right there. you're going to have tackles, which on paper are offensive tackles, but once you get them into camp and you start to evaluate them, they become offensive guards. And Andrew Voorhees is a perfect example of that. He was a guy that we pegged as could be a really good offensive guard for USC. I mean, we looked at him in high school and just how big and strong he was. He reminded me a bit of Chris O'Dowd, just physically. And he played right tackle, you know, early on in camp, which surprised us. He ended up starting and playing some games at right tackle, which still surprised us even more. But as time went on and USC got healthy and they were able to move some guys around, they put Voorhees to guard. And now that's really, I think, his position and where he starts and solidifies himself there going forward at USC and probably even in the pros. And he could be a guy that could have some pro potential down the line. He's got the physique and the frame and I think enough athletic ability where he could be one of those guys. So that's kind of an example of a guy that comes in and on paper, he's an offensive tackle. But then when you start to really see him and evaluate him, you see his full potential was better at guard. And so offensive tackles are just harder to find. It's harder to find guys that have the length, the wingspan, the footwork, the athleticism, just that awareness to be able to play a little bit in space. You got to have some spatial awareness because you get against the team that maybe has a seven technique or a wide nine technique. They're going to put those defensive ends and you're going to be on an island as an offensive tackle. And so you have to have some awareness as to where you are, where the pocket is forming, where your quarterback is. And that's just hard to find. And so there's guys that are on paper, they're offensive tackles. You bring them in and they're rated such and such offensive tackles. We talked about Voorhees, Elijah, Vera Tucker's another guy that USC brought in was, you know, okay, he's going to be an offensive tackle, but you know, he's 6'3", maybe 6'4". And so that length and that stuff, that kind of puts you more into the guard frame. And that's what USC has done is move those guys in. So while on paper they brought in, I think it was like four offensive tackles in the 2017 class. It really was two offensive tackles. It was Austin Jackson, and we've talked about him and whether he's going to actually be a franchise left tackle or a guy that's just going to be solid and very good for them. And then you have Jalen McKenzie, who was brought in as a blue shirt, who's a guy that is kind of coming off an ACL still kind of building himself up, but has a lot of potential, but a guy that's going to be probably a right tackle for USC, but a tackle nonetheless. So you go from having four guys to two guys. So you're always going to want to over-recruit the tackle position because you know some of those guys are going to be able to move in and play guard.
Tarek M. asks, is USC recruiting Treshawn Harrison? He's a 6'2 athlete that runs a 4.3, which fits the speed USC needs at receiver.
Boom, rapid fire answer. Yes. He's going to visit in January, mid-January probably, and is a guy that USC's after. We're going to have to see if he starts looking at Oregon again because he was originally committed to Oregon. You know, maybe Florida State makes a run at him because Willie Taggart's over at Florida State and they were able to get Jaden Woodby. Maybe they got a little confidence. They can think they can go across the country, grab a guy like Treshawn Harrison. Obviously, Washington is there as well, but he already left state once to go to school. So it makes you think, you know what, maybe if USC can put in a little more time. He doesn't know a lot about USC. When he unofficially visited USC over the summer, he came away from that visit not knowing a lot about USC. It was his first time there. He got the actually, he didn't even know he got the scholarship offer. Evidently, his seven-on coaches didn't tell him about it because they wanted him to focus, blah, blah, blah. But long story short, he ended up finding out he had the scholarship offer. But he really didn't have a lot of feel for USC. You know, a lot of kids, at least traditionally, they know about USC, and they always drop the Reggie Bush name. They always drop Matt Leinart, and they talk about Pete Carroll. He didn't really even have that awareness of USC or that sort of reference, at least for USC. So, USC's got some ground to make up as far as that goes, but they have some time now, and Johnny Nance is on them. The real question is going to be, where do they see him fitting in? Is he going to be a receiver? Is he going to be a defensive back? Maybe they talk about him maybe being a running back, perhaps. It's a possibility, too. Dylan McCullough, I know, is not really recruiting him or contacting him, so I don't think that's going to happen. I think it would be probably more sort of an Adoree Jackson role, you know, a guy that could play some receiver and could also probably play defensive back. A very good athlete and a guy that USC is intrigued by.
Rapid fire is good because we have a lot of questions from Tarek M. He says, I recently read the latest War Room and can say the news about Woodby was disappointing, not because he didn't choose USC, but more how we screwed up the in-home visit and how Coach Bradford has only talked to Woodby twice all year. I've made remarks about not only the development of his players, but also his unwillingness to recruit before. This was unacceptable, in my opinion. What are your thoughts on the situation? He also asks, what's the deal with SC dropping the ball on Julius Ervin? So, group question.
Yeah, sort of a compound question there with Ervin and the recruitment of Jaden Woodby. You know, it's tough. I think that USC did make some mistakes there, definitely. And coming from Jaden Woodby's side specifically, there was some missed opportunities there, I think, with some in-home visits and how things were done. I don't want to get into specifics. And like I've said before, I don't like throwing individual coaches under the bus. Certainly, we talked about Ervin as well already, and we kind of went through that at the top of the podcast. I don't want to rehash it all, but they sort of dropped the ball. Somehow, some way, a guy that's a priority recruit, a guy that I know for USC is a priority recruit, ends up thinking that he's being slow played. The communication between the two parties there is obviously not up to par. It needs to be better. There needs to be more consistent communication. And the kids just have to have a clear idea of where USC is coming from if USC really wants the kid and really wants to recruit him hard. And there should be no mistake about that. So, I don't want to get into specifics about what happened or what didn't happen with Woodby. As I said, I think coming away from it in hindsight, it's not a big loss for USC. It's not huge. I understand that, you know, the issue is how it all happened. And that's kind of what was said in the question. You know, it's not such a big deal that we lost them. It's just how things went. Hopefully it's a learning experience for USC. I mean, hopefully USC saw what happened with Woodby and they saw what almost happened with Julius Irvin. And they're able to correct those mistakes and make sure they're just a little more focused and on top of things from that defensive back position in terms of the recruiting trail. And again, maintaining communication and just making sure that you check all your boxes, I guess, when you're doing your in-home visits and you're talking to these kids.
We have a question from Bearsecutor who says, GM Bree Solomon T, how does he fit in regard to the four linebackers already signed for 2018? How does he fit in Clancy's defense with the other four linebackers?
Well, we talked a lot about this, actually. I mean, we've gone over this quite a bit. Hasn't really changed, although now you have Abdul Malik McLean, who is also an early signee, who flipped from UCLA and is now committed to USC. He looks like he's going to be a Predator, though. He doesn't really play the same position as Solomon Tuliaupupu. He's really going to be a Predator, 6'4", 230 pounds, a pass rusher, a guy that has his hand on the ground most of the time in high school and is really been a tremendous pass rusher. I think he had something like 18 sacks this year, 17 tackles for losses. At a school which plays tremendous competition, Jay Sarah, and the year before that, he was playing at Santa Margarita. So he's been in that Trinity League and was co-defensive player of the year as a senior this year. So a guy that's had a tremendous senior year, got a lot better, and somebody that USC, I think they just saw and said, you know what, we need to get this guy now. He's a good football player. And they basically gave up Bo Calvert, who was committed to USC for a long time from Oaks Christian, 6'5", 220-pound linebacker, to get Abdul McLean Malik. And so that was one of those things that I think USC just, again, it was how good of a football player McLean was and how well he did on tape against really good competition and a guy that was a little more proficient and a little more established and had production from the pass rush standpoint, from a rush end standpoint. He was a proven commodity, so they went on him. So that's your Predator right there. Raymond Scott, we've talked about him being able to kind of bounce around a bit. I think he's more of a will linebacker in USC scheme as an inside linebacker. Palaye Yoteote is going to be potentially a Mike linebacker. Again, and we've talked about this a lot, so I mean, it's really a question we're kind of going over, but for this particular podcast, we'll talk about it. You know, with Yoteote, he could definitely play Mike linebacker. If Cam Smith leaves, then I think you put him at Mike linebacker. But if Cam Smith comes back for his senior year, I think potentially you could put Yoteote at the same linebacker spot because you are going to lose Yechenna Nwosu. And that's a big loss, and you need some bodies at that spot. And I think you need the physicality from a guy like Yoteote at that spot. Whereas Solomon Tuliaupupu, I think as an inside linebacker, you like him there. He's played that spot pretty much all through high school. He knows Mike linebacker. That's kind of sort of been his bread and butter. I think if Cam Smith comes back, then you can kind of put him behind Cam Smith and you can allow him to grow a little more. But if Cam Smith doesn't come back, and then maybe you have to have some more physicality at that spot, that's where you put Palaite, and then maybe you got to put Solomon over at the Sam spot and get him some run there because Solomon Tuliaupupu is also a very good athlete. In fact, I would say he might be a better flat-out athlete from a number standpoint than Yoteote. I think he's a little faster. I think he probably moves north and south a little quicker. He can be a guy that could come off the edge and be a wrecking ball. I mean, that's totally his style. He's very aggressive. He's kind of a bull in a china shop when it comes to his style of play. So I could see those guys being somewhat interchangeable. The one thing with Yoteote is just he's 245, 250 pounds. And Solomon is a little more like 225. So you're just talking about if you're going to put somebody up at the line of scrimmage and they got to play that position that Nwosu plays, which is that Sam linebacker spot, you're playing against offensive linemen. You're taking on offensive tackles. You've got to be strong. You've got to be big. You've got to be able to anchor. And I think if he's the guy that you're replacing over Cam Smith and Cam Smith comes back, then potentially you can put Yoti Ote at that spot, and you may have a guy that can anchor a little more. And obviously, we talked about Jordan Iosefa. I mean, I think that's a spot that he probably ends up going over to. He's not a natural predator. He's playing that spot in a pinch because of injuries and because Porter Gustin's been hurt. And obviously, we have to see what's going to happen with Porter Gustin if he comes back, which I think he's probably going to come back. We'll see if he's able to play in this bowl game or something happens where he's able to have a big game. I just don't see it, and I haven't really kept up as to how much he's practicing during the bowl week. But I think he doesn't have enough film right now as a junior to be able to come out. I think it would be advantageous for him to come back next year. And so that would obviously free up Iosefa to be able to play that Sam linebacker spot. And I think that's obviously a guy that, with the maturity and having played the last 2 years, he'd be able to come in and step in, and it wouldn't be such a huge transition. You're going to lose something with Nwosu leaving because he's just that good, but you can have a guy that comes in that's got some experience under his belt and can at least be at that spot and hold it down. That's the thing. You have a certain level expectations, a certain amount of play that you need that required to make the system work, and I think Jordan Iosefa could more than enough be able to contribute and play up to that level.
And as far as Solomon goes, Bearsecutor wants to know, how does the JT Daniel commit and presumptive Amon-Ra St. Brown signing help USC in getting Solomon?
I think a little bit. I mean, he's got a couple guys there that, again, were part of a tremendously successful high school football team. Now, Solomon was only there for a year. He transferred over from Claremont High School, so he hasn't necessarily been at Modern Day the whole time. But I'm sure those guys, they'll have an opportunity to be in his ear a lot more. Certainly if you're going to high school with a guy and you have classes with a guy, you can continue to hit him up, and USC will have access to Solo through those guys. They can get a hold of those guys and say, hey, man, we haven't heard from Solo. We don't know what's going on with Solo. And those guys will have classes with them, and they'll be on campus with them. And so it helps. I don't know that it's going to be a deal breaker for him. Like I said, that he's new to Modern Day to some extent, relatively, and I don't know that he's necessarily very close with those two offensive players. I know he's close with Mace Funa. Mace Funa is a guy that's a junior and an outside linebacker that USC is recruiting very hard and has offered a scholarship, and a guy that I think USC has a good shot at landing as well. But from the relationship standpoint of the guys on the offensive side of the ball, probably not strong enough that it's going to be some kind of big deal breaker. It's certainly not as impactful as JT Daniels committing and enrolling early as it is for, Amon-Ra, because those guys are obviously quarterback, receiver. There's a great relationship. They're on the field and off the field. And so that really plays. So not quite as much with Solomon, but it will help USC to some extent.
Yeah, we have another question. Who do you see USC flipping from a Pac-12 school this year outside of offensive guard? I ask because we have been on a streak dating back to 2014 with Jonathan Lockett. Thank you, and fight on, Randall in Dallas by way of New Orleans.
That's a tough question, man. I first of all, I think what we're talking about with OG, I think we're talking about Elijah Griffin, not offensive guard.
Oh, my God. See, these people, they write these questions, and I'm just reading them. You guys have to be more specific. I guess they didn't expect me to be reading them.
Yeah, it's the lingo. It's the lingo. I mean, Ryan might even have fallen into that one. but it's, I think, yeah, with Elijah Griffin, obviously, he's still technically committed to UCLA, which is interesting. I mean, a lot of people keep anticipating that he's going to decommit and he's going to decommit, but he's still technically committed to UCLA. USC's not really pushing for a lot of other guys that are committed to other schools right now. There's not a lot of guys on the board. I think really for USC, it's the guys that are uncommitted. Certainly, we talked about Elijah Griffin being a potential guy that he definitely could be one of those guys, and I think they're starting to push a little harder for him. And I think obviously losing Jaden Woodby opens the door more for a three cornerback, one safety class, which I personally thought that should be the way USC should go from the jump. I thought that was sort of how they were going to do it probably about midseason. And then, Woodby came available. And I think it was just one of those things, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, maybe. And if you could get Hufanga and Woodby done early, it's like, boom, that's great. Let's get it done now. We're going to take two quality players now. We're going to be aggressive. And then in January, we'll see how things sort out. Well, didn't work out that way, but they still could potentially get Elijah Griffin We talked about Julius Irvin a lot. And then the other guy that hasn't really come up yet on the podcast is Isaac Taylor Stewart, yep. The 6'2", 195-pound cornerback from Helix High School down there in San Diego. And so another guy that's, you know, high on USC's board. So they could potentially bring in three cornerbacks. You got to put Treshawn Harrison in that mix too. He's a guy that could definitely play cornerback and could play receiver, could be a both-way guy. So now all of a sudden you have some reasonably good options there at cornerback. And so – you know, when you've got a few that you can play around with, it definitely, when they're regional and you don't have to go across the country to Florida or Ohio or South Carolina or some crazy place to try to recruit, makes things a lot easier for USC. And so we'll see how they sort of, you know, size this up a bit and figure out, you know, what they're going to do with that cornerback position. But right now, I mean, OG is kind of the only guy that's really high on the list that I could see that USC is really pushing for. Maybe some guys start to shake loose. You know, the funny thing about this early signing period, and this is going to happen, and this is, again, I think where the backlash will come in a few years, you're going to see a lot of assistant coaching moves, a lot of assistant coaching moves. There'll be hundreds of assistant coaches leaving schools, getting fired from schools, getting hired by schools. You also have the 10th coach, the 10th mm-hmm. full-time assistant that schools will be able to bring in January 8th. That's going to be significant. You're going to see a lot of movement from the coaching standpoint. And I know it's not going to be a lot of head coaches moving, but the assistant coaches, obviously, they have a lot of push and impact on the recruiting process as well, because a lot of the kids have really good relationships with their position coaches. And so when you see all these movements and all these guys are already signed, some of these kids are going to be going, damn, I messed up. I shouldn't have signed early. I should have waited. And so that's going to also impact some things. So potentially that could open some doors with USC, whether it be in the Pac-12 or other schools. But right now, yeah, I think Elijah Griffin is kind of the guy that's probably the most notable, at least, that's already committed to a Pac-12 school that USC may continue to recruit and try to flip.
You kind of already touched on this with what you just answered, but Blake in South Orange County asks, where does SC go now at safety with Woodby off the board and the relationship with Irvin seeming to be on the rocks?
Yeah, I think they're going to be okay with Irvin. And Irvin, though, is not really a safety prospect for USC. He's a corner, and they like him as a corner, and he really wants to play cornerback. His dad, Leroy, played cornerback for the Rams in the NFL for a while, played for a few teams, actually. And that's sort of the position he wants to play. And I think it's a position he can play. And especially with USC, because USC is using five defensive backs. They're using sort of the nickel corner, or they use a nickel safety. I think it really sort of depends on who they feel is the best player for that position and kind of probably the matchup for them that week. They have their two corners, and then they have more two traditional safeties that are free and strong that play in the back end. So you've got more than just the traditional two safety positions that they play. You actually have three safety positions if they're actually going with the sort of the nickel safety as opposed to nickel corner, which they're doing more with Ajani Harris being a guy right now that they're using. But I think in future they want to get bigger. And I think a guy like Irvin, definitely just across the board, you know, being 6'1", almost 6'2", 185 pounds. I've watched him play in person. He's not your traditional safety at the high school level. He's not a guy that just floats around in the middle of the field, which you go and see a lot of the top safeties, and you really just don't get to see a lot of production from them because they sort of float in the middle of the field and they don't always get involved with things. But Irvin was a guy that played man coverage a lot, played over the slot, saw him play against Mission Viejo in their last game, and played against the kid that's committed to Washington, whose name escapes me right now, but a really good receiver, who runs really good routes and is really on top of just, you know, being able to exploit defenses, very smart kid. And Irvin locked him up and locked him down. And I've seen him do that multiple times in person. And just with the bloodlines and how smart he is, how much of a competitor he is, he comes up to the line, he runs support. He's a guy that is sort of a Swiss Army knife of sorts. And so that's a big get for USC if they're able to lock him down and able to close with him, which I think they're going to have an opportunity to do. I wouldn't necessarily categorize or phrase it as they're on the rocks with him. I think it was a close call with him signing early and probably going to Notre Dame. But I think USC is able to sort of, you know, get their bearings back and be able to focus in as we get, you know, into January, and they get that official visit, they get that in-home visit, and they should be able to close the deal with him. But that, again, that's a cornerback. And then we're looking at USC, really, I think, with three cornerbacks and one safety. I don't know that you need to have a quote-unquote safety in the class. I mean, technically, they wouldn't have any safeties because Talanoa Hufanga is an athlete. you know, rated as an athlete, but we know he projects as a safety. But I don't know you need another guy. We talked about in the past Jamel Cook potentially transferring. We've had some sources say, you know, imply that that's probably a likelihood. Perhaps some other guys on the team that are looking around at the safety position as well. We talked about the potential of Isaiah Pulumau, maybe moving up and playing a little bit of linebacker. There's a lot of stuff that can change. And yeah, you could say, well, maybe you need two safeties. I just don't see it as being just something that's really an immediate need right now on paper, you know? And so I don't know that they need another safety, but they should get at least two cornerbacks and potentially three. And if you're bringing in big guys that are 6'1", 6'2", I mean, those guys could always transition to end up playing safety in USC's scheme.
Yeah. Targ LaCour says, does USC have to take a tight end in this class, or could they take through three receivers instead?
That's a good question. It's a bit open-ended. I think they would like to take Mike Ezeke, who was committed to Oregon until Willie Taggart left, and a guy that USC was recruiting pretty hard, and recruiting him hard when Cameron McDonald decommitted, and gave me the impression that they wanted him over Cameron McDonald. And looking at his physique and looking at him just physically and how he plays, I think long-term he will be a better tight end prospect. He's less of a tweener, I think, when you get him into his, you know, sophomore year, you know, maybe a redshirt sophomore year if he needs to redshirt. I think he's a guy that will end up being that 240-pound tight end with the long arms and good speed and just really a good athlete. And so overall, I think that's one guy that they're definitely circling the wagons with. They were recruiting a few other guys. It's sort of been a position where it's A, not real deep, and some of the options have fallen through. I think Ezeke is still a potential get for them as a tight end, but that is perhaps where maybe if you don't have another guy on the board that you really like, you don't just take a tight end to take a tight end. Maybe you go and take that third receiver, right? I think there's still a decision to be made there.
And then Tark also asked, how much of a shot does USC have with Devin Williams?
They have a fair shot. My inclination is just, I think he leans towards UCLA, and I could see the hype behind Chip Kelly going to UCLA and his offense and everything that comes with it, getting to Devin Williams and him sort of going along for the ride. I think that, you know, he has always sort of leaned more towards UCLA. His head coach up there, Antelope Valley, is former UCLA player, Jermaine Lewis. I think there's just more familiarity and comfort with UCLA as a school. And while, you know, you could question, I'm sure there's USC fans that are going to say, well, wait, Gerard, Chip Kelly's offense. I mean, how many great receivers were produced in Chip Kelly's offense? How many guys are Pro Bowl receivers? How many guys won first round picks? You know, how many of those top players that were with Oregon during his run ended up going to the NFL and doing anything? Yeah, there's not a lot of names that come to mind, but that doesn't mean that there's still not hype and there's still not sort of some momentum that's built up about having a prolific offense. Whether it's not really necessarily prolific from the standpoint of being a receiver, it's still going to be passed off as that, and it's still got some momentum, and there's still going to be hype around it. And I think Devin is the kind of guy that could definitely get caught up in that. And again, I think just inherently he likes UCLA more than USC. USC's recruiting him. USC likes him. They push for him. But I think that's going to be surprisingly tough, regardless of what USC does in the bowl game, regardless of anything else. I think I still could see him being a UCLA guy. So I think it's, you know, there's potential there, but I would probably say UCLA is the team to beat. Oregon is still recruiting him. Oregon for a while was thought to be the team to beat. But I think there's a lot of question marks there with the new staff and whether that staff is actually going to be there beyond next year. You know, it's sort of a interim staff that was made a full-time staff, but there's still a lot of question marks there. And I could see that being something that sort of changes sort of where he was going to go with Oregon. So I think it becomes a USC UCLA battle, and we'll just see, you know, I think he could just buy in to Chip Kelly being a head coach. And I think there's a few guys that, you know, locally are going to look at that. And if they're open enough, I think UCLA could steal them at the last minute. And I don't know if I would call Devin Williams a real steal, but I think Devin Williams could be definitely one of those guys that could end up at UCLA.
Interesting. Okay, we have a couple more questions for you. I know you're probably getting tired. Actually, no, you like to talk, so we'll see.
I'm going. Let's go for another hour. Let's do it.
Jerry D says, in terms of running back recruiting, what happens to Salahuddin? Thought of him and Marquis Stepp would really be a nice thunder and lightning combo.
Yeah, although they were never committed at the same time. Michael Salahuddin actually decommitted, and then it was like the next day or later that day, I think, that Marquis Stepp actually committed. So two ships passing in the night from that standpoint. But yeah, on paper, that's kind of a nice little combo. I mean, they certainly have different attributes and different traits as running backs. Salahuddin, I wouldn't classify as lightning. He's just not that fast, to be honest with you. He's quick. And he's got good vision and he's shifty, but he's actually probably a little more physical and more of a power back than people give him credit for. Whereas Marquis Stepp is obviously, you know, 230 pounds, really more of a straightforward inline type power back. He sort of fits that mold and that you kind of make for him just looking at him on paper. Salahuddin, for backstory, and we talked about this a little bit on the Peristyle, but to give backstory for the podcast. His mom and I think his family are really the ones holding him back from going to USC. I don't think it has to do with him leaving home. I think it's just his family not wanting him to leave home. And his mom had a little episode, little health episode when she was on her official visit. And I think that, I mean, you could read into that a lot of different ways. It was sort of like a fainting spell evidently or something. And, you know, USC had to call paramedics and a whole thing. And it was, I think it was the night of the game. He ended up going to the game with his grandma. But then coming away from that, you do have to know, you know, if his mom's pushing back a bit on him going away from home, you know, what was that all about? And so there's a lot of local pressure. And it's funny because, I mean, you think of local pressure and you go, Washington, D.C.? What local pressure at Maryland? I mean, you know, what local pressure is there to go to Maryland? But there's local pressure. And he doesn't have to necessarily go to Maryland. It could be just, you know, closer to home, UNC. Could be some other schools there in the ACC that, you know, he could go to and be closer to home. That would be a compromise pick. USC's still recruiting him. They still want him. They're still pushing for him. And I think he's appreciative of that. And I think it looked like it just wasn't going to happen. I think there's still potential for him to get back into the fold. And I think the resilience and sort of just the continued push and we're not going to give up on you has always worked out for USC. It's always been something, even going back to Pete Carroll's staffs, just being relentless and staying after it. A lot of coaching staffs don't do that. And when they think the door is being shut on them, they see themselves out. USC doesn't do it. They stick their foot in the door and they keep pushing. They keep pushing. And I think with Salahuddin, Dylan McCullough is doing that right now. And I think there's a little bit of, oh, you know, I mean, these guys really want me. It's just going to be tough. It's going to be a tough choice between can I leave against really my family's wishes or do I just keep my family satisfied and keep everybody copacetic and just stay closer to home even though it's not a school that I really want to go to, like I want to go to USC. So he's still on the table. He's still potentially a commit for USC down the line. It's going to be a signing day decision most likely. We're just going to see what happens. USC's definitely got to get themselves some other options, and there's not a lot of other options out there, but they're going to have to sort of cultivate some other options and find maybe another guy that can be a lightning type of guy that can go along with Marquis Stepp.
And that's it. You kind of briefly touched on this, but Tark asks, what does Marquis Stepp bring to the Trojans' backfield along with the other running backs that USC has?
He's a power back. He's a guy that gets behind his shoulder pads and gets straightforward and has straightforward lean. I liked Jeremy Banks a little more on film, to be honest with you. He ended up committing to Tennessee with that new staff, and it was like bada boom, bada bing. Next thing you know, he's Tennessee, which was funny because Tennessee really wasn't recruiting him all that hard previously, and he kind of had Tennessee off his list for a while. But then you have Jeremy Pruitt come in. You have the new coaching staff come in. You know, obviously Tyson Helton had some familiarity perhaps with Jeremy Banks. He didn't recruit Jeremy Banks. It's all been Dylan McCullough, but he was on the recruiting board for USC, so he was familiar somewhat with Jeremy Banks, and I'm sure he said, hey, you know, we're going to do the same thing we did at USC, and you're going to get to stay close to home, blah, blah, blah. I like Jeremy Banks. I think he's a good-looking player on film and had really good measurables. I think with Stepp, he just seems like a little more straight-line, linear runner vision-wise. Kind of a little more like you got to have a hole for him. And if you got a hole for him, then he could push it. You know, Steve Wiltfong, the director of recruiting for 24/7, lives in Indiana. And so he's had an opportunity to see Marquis Stepp play in person and said some great things about him and says, you know, he's a guy that actually has really good speed, seen him to go 98 yards before. The biggest issue with him and the reason why he slipped on a lot of people's boards is that he had a lot of hamstring issues. And the hamstring issues kept coming up time again. And that's something that can be degenerative, that can be something that is kind of a chronic issue. USC, obviously, they know about it. This is not a something that's new to USC. Dylan McCullough actually knows Marquis' stepdad. They went to school together at Miami of Ohio. And so they know each other very well, and he knows the family very well. So he knows Marquis' step, and he knows the medical issues and any kind of questions that are there. So USC's done the research, and they just feel like that's an issue that he's had in high school for whatever purposes, whatever reasons. They can be able to train him up and get him out of having those issues, and then they get a guy that at, you know, full health is one of the best running backs in the Midwest for sure. And he's done it against really good competition. He played against some really good schools, Detroit King, Decatur in Indiana. He's played against a few different schools there in that region and been very successful and had some big games against them. We're talking about 200-yard rushing games, multiple touchdowns. So if he's healthy, he's a really good-looking power back, a guy that physically kind of around maybe Trey Madden when he graduated around there. But a guy that is really more of a straight-up running back that's going to run behind his pads and be a guy that can get first downs on third and three.
Ben asks, what's the story behind the decommitment of Bo Calvert?
We kind of touched on that a little bit. He's off the board for USC for a long time. I think by October, we knew for sure he wasn't going to be a part of the class. And I think that's when USC started pivoting and looking for a guy that was more of a ready-made, proven pass rusher. And I think that's where Abdul Malik McClain comes in. I think that's where you're getting a guy that is really a pass rush. I don't want to say specialist because I think he brings more to the table. I mean, I think he's very good against the run as well. But a guy that does on paper and on film against good competition, get sacks and get pressures on the quarterback. And I think that's the big sell for USC. And it's less of, well, Bo Calvert's a guy that is a very good athlete, ran one of the best 40 times at the opening regional, but as a guy that still has to grow into his body, the best comparison I could make maybe is a Dallas Sarts type of guy. Although Dallas Sarts was playing safety in high school, so I don't know if Bo Calvert could play safety. I think it just came down to, we just like Abdul Malik McClain as a football player more. I think he's just maybe a better football player right now and a more proven commodity, and we want to go on him. And I think that was really the determination that USC made. Cameron Latu was another guy that they looked at and they recruited for a while. He ended up committing to Alabama. And so it really became, okay, we're going to get a predator in this class, which, you know, I've talked about it before. I don't know that's a need. Maybe there's going to be some movement there with Connor Murphy. Maybe he moves inside and plays more defensive tackle for USC or defensive end in their scheme, actually. You know, we'll see what happens with Oluwale Betiku. You've still got who am I missing? You've got Hunter Eccles, who's still there as a true freshman. And then you've got Porter Gustin, who could really come back next year. So you could be four or five deep at that position. If all those guys are still playing that position next fall camp, we're just going to have to see again if Connor Murphy moves inside. That would be the most obvious choice for some movement there that I could see happening. But it's a very deep position that I didn't necessarily think USC needed a guy, but they ended up getting a guy and again, a guy that's a proven commodity as a pass rusher.
We have a question about Liam Douglas. How would you compare his talent? And do you think he's a project considering, if people don't know, he's only played tackle football for a couple of years.
He is a project, definitely. He is a guy that is raw and still has to build up his body. Comparison, you know, if you want the high comparison of what could be, you look at Chad Wheeler, guy that comes into USC at about 250, 255 pounds, a volleyball player, and builds himself up to being a guy that now is playing for the NFL. I think he got his first start this year for the Giants. Yep. I mean, that's crazy. There's a lot of people that never thought that would happen. but that's what you get on the West Coast. You get a lot of guys. They're not 300 pounds when they come out of high school. They're 250 pounds, 240 pounds, and you got to put the weight on them, and you have to develop them in the weight room. And so upside-wise, that's a potential guy. I don't know if I necessarily see that because I don't think Liam Douglas is a guy that's going to be a tackle, let alone a left tackle. I think USC brings him in, again, to use that term Swiss Army knife. I think he can play multiple positions. He prides himself on playing multiple positions, center, guard, offensive tackle, and I think that's kind of what he does, and that's where USC likes him. They can kind of plug him in at a few different positions. He's going to take some time to develop, though. He's going to take a red shirt, and then we're going to see what happens, you know, later down the line. He's played against really small ball competition at Harvard Westlake, and so it's hard to say, you know, against that top-notch competition, once he gets to be a full product, what he's going to look like. But that's what you pay Neil Callaway for. That's what you pay you know, the strength and conditioning staff for. They all have to be in communication and be able to project and look at a guy and say, okay, this is what he's going to be with 30 pounds in another couple years. But then, and you have to make a living at that in the Pac-12 and the West Coast, because that's a lot of the guys that come out. It's not the South where dudes are coming out of high school and they're 330 pounds. You know, it's just kids are not built like that. They're playing multiple sports. They play baseball. They play volleyball. They play basketball. They do track. And it's year round because of the weather. And of course, there's the beach. And so you don't want to be a big bubba going out to the beach looking like a whale. So, you know, kids out here, they're not, it's not the same thing. You got to build them up in college and get the right weight on them and get them to that 280, 290. And so you have to be able to project what they're going to look like when they get there.
Well, speaking of the staff, we have a question from Daryl from San Antonio, who says he's a longtime listener, first time question asker. Thank you for asking a question, Daryl. He says, I'm curious about the process of recruiting a player. Specifically, what is the psychology of approaching players, family, and or coaches? Who keeps track of all the players? What percent of the budget is specifically for recruiting?
Wow, there's a lot of question there.
Yeah. Three-part question.
I don't know exactly what the recruiting budget is or the percentage that goes to recruiting and what's given to the football program as a whole. It's, USC is a private school, so those numbers are not readily available. I think the organization comes down to A, Eric Ziskin, who is a personnel director and really, I think, has a lot of control over the board and sort of, you know, what the needs are and trying to organize things. Alex Rios is involved a lot with, I think, itineraries and visits and things like that. You get a lot of student workers in there that are very involved as well. So it's an administration sort of thing where you've got a lot of people that are involved trying to organize things and get your ducks in a row. But it's a nuanced question with numbers and things that I think USC likes to kind of keep close to the vest. But it's definitely about as chaotic as you can imagine it being. I mean, there's a lot of numbers, there's a lot of juggling, there's a lot of balancing, there's constant maneuvering. And I think, you know, with USC, there's a lot of experience coming from the sanctions, which really made it hard. I mean, it's normally complicated. There's a lot of rules with the NCAA that change from year to year. But you take it to a whole nother level when you're putting in limitations and restrictions because of sanctions. And so that was hard just for us from a compliance standpoint to know what's possible and what was not possible. And so they come out of the sanctions having some of that experience. And I think that helps them going forward, just being able to really kind of, like I said, juggle numbers and sort of know what's possible and what's not possible. Thinking outside the box, I think a good support staff is a support staff that recruiting-wise – they really know their rules and they know how to think outside the box, because there's always some school doing something new. And if you're late to the party, you're going to miss out on opportunities to be able to blue shirt, be able to gray shirt, be able to count this guy against two classes before because this other guy transferred to a school that wasn't in your conference and it wasn't Division I. There's all kinds of weird loopholes and things that you have to read into. So you're always working with compliance and you're always working with those guys. So I would say, you know, the two guys that I know up front that are very involved with that in terms of organization, it definitely a lot falls on Eric Ziskin and a lot falls on Alex Rios. And then you got other support staff guys like Gavin Morris who are just – Gavin's really more of a ace recruiter. He's more of a, you know, ace in the hole sort of, you know, secret weapon type of guy that, you know, USC's put on the road a few times, kind of like what Kenyatta Hudson was before he left for Florida Atlantic. So the guys that are really organization-wise, you got to work with, you know, guys like Johnny Nansen and the full-time staff is really from a communication standpoint. It's going to be Eric Ziskin and Alex Rios. And I'm sure there's other guys that I'm missing, but yeah, there's a whole department.
As far as compliance goes, how much is that affect USC? I mean, we were during the early signing period, we were waiting for things to come in. How much of that was compliance, making sure everything was good to go?
Compliance it's tough. It's a double-edged sword. Compliance can help you and compliance can also handicap you a lot. And there's a lot of things that compliance has done that has handicapped USC over the past few years. And we feel, I mean, from our own perspective, and I say our own, I just USCfootball.com, maybe from a media standpoint in general, the compliance has sort of had a knee-jerk reaction to sanctions, and they over-comply to a large extent. I mean, an example would be we can't take photos of recruits on campus at all, ever, in any condition, any event, any circumstances. The SID is on our butts about not taking photos of recruits. Like, it's this big violation. Well, if you go and you look on the internet and you go look at the Notre Dame site, you go look at the Nebraska site, you go look at the Florida State site, you look at the Ole Miss site, the Auburn site, even UCLA to a large extent, you got plenty of pictures of recruits on campus, whether it be at games, whether it be at camps, just all kinds of different events. And I actually should correct myself. We can and we have been able to take photos of recruits actually at the camps recently, the Rising Stars camps. When they opened up, we could take video and photos. So we do have that. So that did change sort of post-sanction. So we are grateful for that. But there's other silly things where kids are on an official visit where you got schools all over the nation. And it's a majority of Division I where media can take pictures of recruits all the time. It doesn't matter. Put them up on the internet. This kid, you got plenty of pictures of Amon-Ra St. Brown with his dad at Notre Dame at the game, pregame. You know, and he's got his little name tag on and everything. For whatever reason, USC interprets that from a compliance standpoint as publicity and them marketing, which it's confusing to me. I don't know how that can be. Certainly when USC takes their own pictures of recruits and you got guys like Telano Hufanga or maybe Caleb Tremblay, who you just saw on our front page a little bit ago, those pictures I think were taken by USC and put out by USC before those guys actually committed. So it's like, okay, I mean, that's pictures of recruits on campus that you guys are putting out. How is that not compliant? How is that compliant?
Technically, it was at the Coliseum if you're going to have a loophole, but yes.
But even if we're at the Coliseum during a game, we can't take pictures as media.
That's true.
So because it's considered that we are publicizing a recruit, or USC is actually publicizing a recruit through us. We are kind of a avenue or a vessel of promotion of a recruit on a visit. And that's illegal, but yet they're able to take pictures of recruits themselves while they're on their visits and give them the recruits to put them out. I don't know. But anyways, that's one of those things. It's an over-compliance standpoint. When you see lines of kids waiting to get into practice or waiting to get into games and they need, you know, blood work and photo IDs and, you know, birth certificates and all this other kind of stuff because compliance says so. That's overkill. That's a lot of stuff that handicaps USC. And I think it's gotten better over the last couple years, but it's still something that I hear time and time again. It's like we're working against ourselves here. You know, it's like we're trying to recruit. We're trying to do things that other schools are doing, but we can't because we have compliance that is over complying. And we have more rules that we had more hurdles that are sort of arbitrary that we have to go over because that's the interpretation of the NCAA, even though no other schools, whether it be in the conference or in the nation, are actually complying by that same interpretation.
Interesting. Interesting. I didn't mean to get you on a compliance rant. Bear Secutor asks, and I think it's our last question. He says, I was wondering if you could go over the mechanics/details of signing. I assume the process is the same whether it's this month or a January date. Can the school send a letter out any time? Even if the player signs, he has to wait for a school to receive and sign? I.e., they can revoke a letter even at the last moment when the student has signed. Why would any player, quote-unquote, shut things down entirely and not sign in December?
Okay.
That was a lot.
One question at a time here. The process is the same to my knowledge. You get the letter of intent. The letter of intent cannot be sent out at any time. I think you get a week or a couple days out from the signing period where they will send you that letter of intent. And you can sign that letter of intent, but you can't send it in and fax it in until that signing period, that window opens up. That goes for the early signing period and that goes for February as well. In terms of kids not signing during the early signing period as opposed to signing during the signing period, I mean, we talked about that already. I think obviously if you've got the potential to take more visits and look at more schools, you kind of think you would want to take those and you want to go through that process. A lot can happen in January with assistant coaches moving and that change. And we talked about that as well. And I think that's going to be significant when we see there's going to be some movements, some hirings and some firings. That could definitely impact some kids and would have impacted some kids if they would have not assigned. What was else? There's some other, I think, a part of the question I didn't answer.
Can the school send out the letter at any time?
Yeah, they can't. No, it's got to be a few days out from signing day, I believe it is. I want to say it's like 4 or 5 days, like almost like a week. They can send that letter out and then the kid can sign and send it in. Another part of the question I think was, does the school actually have to sign that signed letter. It's not like a contract. It's not like that. They have it signed. Everybody's already got their signature and everything, their stamp on it. Once the prospect signs the letter of intent and sends it in, it's a done deal. It's official. So you will not see schools. They're not going to send out a bunch of different LOIs and then have a bunch of kids sign them, and then the kids sign them in, and then whoever they sign off on, okay, that's cool, we're going to take you. No, it doesn't work like that. It's not that kind of contract. It's signed and done from the school's perspective once they mail it out. So you better mail out to the kids that you want to take. So something that Lonnie Ford, who is defensive line coach at Vista Marietta High School, former Trojan, former tight end and defensive end for USC, a guy that is a friend of mine and I'm known for a number of years, he made the great remark a few years ago, actually. He says, you know what, man? He goes, the offer game anymore is BS. Nobody cares about offers. Everybody gets offers. Keely, we're going to give you a scholarship offer to go to USC, play football, because we heard you're so good at Pop Warner playing football. We saw your picture on Facebook and Instagram. It was amazing. We're going to offer you a scholarship. Keely, it doesn't mean anything. They offer kids scholarships like that every day. Lonnie said the perfect thing. He said, how many LOIs do you have? Tell me that. Tell me how many letter of intents you get before signing it. Then I'll consider that as how good of a player you are, because that is the truth of the matter. It's how many letter of intents you have, because that is the binding clause. That is the contract which you can sign and send to the school, and you are now a part of that school. So schools do not send out a lot of LOIs. They send out the kids that they want, that they think they're going to get, and that's it. So that's always the thing about the LOI is, you know, if a kid has an LOI, the school is certainly recruiting him then.
Very true indeed. That's some wisdom that I think we can close this recruiting podcast on. Any final thoughts? I know that you and Ryan are going to the All-American game next week.
Next week we'll be at the U.S. Army All-American Bowl in San Antonio, going down to the Riverwalk, which is a annual thing for us. And so we're going to check out a ton of USC prospects there, a bunch of commits, a bunch of guys like Amon-Ra St. Brown, as we talked about, probably going to make an announcement there at the game. JT Daniels will be playing for the West. We're going to get to see him as a senior, a reclassified senior, playing for the West squad as well. So Chris Trevino had a little bit of a preview. We'll probably preview it more going forward, but it's going to be stacked with a lot of USC recruits, as always. And so we'll be there live and doing updates and getting you a bunch of news and photos and video and everything that you're used to from USCfootball.com from the U.S. Army All-American Bowl.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of content, so stay tuned for that. But that's going to wrap it up for our recruiting podcast, wrapping up the early signing day process, all of that. That's Gerard Martinez that you heard from GMAR Live. Follow him. He's a good follow. And that will wrap it up. Hopefully Ryan will be back podcasting and he's not as deathly sick as he is now. The Cotton Bowl is coming up very soon, so we'll have a lot of content from that. And we'll see you guys soon.